welcome to Worlds Apart. Since its inception, the United States has taken pride in its unique sense of national destiny and purpose, which supposedly set it apart from all other nations. As the United States approaches its 250th anniversary, its exceptionalism increasingly takes on more ominous tones, routinely breaking not only international law, but also basic norms of decency and sanity. Why do the Americans still find it cool to be the exception to the rule? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Aaron Good, a political scientist and author of American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. Mr. Good, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, I know that you are an expert on American exceptionalism, which in popular perception is essentially understood as the Americans insisting to be better than anyone else at any time, in any circumstance. But I take it from your book that this sense of exceptionalism actually has a pretty elaborate philosophical thinking beneath it. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's a term that has two relevant meanings here, and I mean to invoke both of them. There's the idea of American exceptionalism, which is that United States is this city on a hill. It doesn't have the problems and corruption of other nations. It's a beacon of democracy and freedom for the whole world. And then there is the idea of the exception, which is a concept that comes from the Nazis, unfortunately. And it's the idea of back when they had a republic, the Weimar Republic after World War I, which wasn't a very strong government, you eventually have the Nazis come to power. And the basis of their policies, the Führer principle and the right of the state to do anything to protect the state, it comes from the idea that there's such an emergency that the state must be allowed to operate in a state of exception, meaning a state of exception to the rule of law, meaning that whatever needs to be done to protect the state is okay. And this is an idea that gets more or less enshrined in the U.S. in policy after World War II, when the U.S. decides that it is going to go for global dominance.
Now, I don't think there is a single country or people in the world that are not unique or not exceptional because of the very specific interplay of various geographical, economical, cultural factors. But I gather that this American sense of exceptionalism or entitlement really is centering on the question of power and the ability to use that power on a whim. And in your book, you suggest that there are sort of two realities of the American power. There is this popular myth about the United States as indeed this shining city on a hill. And then there is a shadowy reality of how the Americans are practicing that power. And it's almost like having a family and cheating on the side. You know, that takes a lot of time, a lot of resources. Why do you think the Americans prefer to maintain these two parallel structures as opposed to, you know, investing all their resources into building one coherent system that indeed be what is preached?
Well, there's the idea of soft power in international relations, which is that the U.S. would want to appeal to countries because the U.S. is appealing, because people want to be like us. Oh, there's all these things that we would like to put out there as positive, including democracy, the Bill of Rights, free speech. So this is a way. And at the end of World War II, there was more substance to this. I mean, there was the four, and it was moving in a positive direction with Roosevelt's idea of the four freedoms to make sure that people had jobs and enough to eat and freedom from persecution of all kinds. So there was some substance to this, but when they make the decision to go for global dominance and to be the hegemon of global capitalism, they are going to have to commit crimes that, essentially, they're going to have to overthrow governments that they don't like. So, for example, Iran is the most famous early case in the CIA. A leader of Iran who was democratically elected tried to nationalize Iranian oil. And so the CIA intervenes and overthrows the government and installs a puppet, the Shah, to run Iran for the benefit of Western oil majors. So they don't want to say that they are doing this. They want to be able to look appealing to, especially the colonized world, the remnants of the colonized world at the end of World War II, and the decolonizing world. They want to win hearts and minds. And so the mythology of the United States as this constitutional republic that cares about the welfare and freedom of the people, this is needed even as there is a hidden hand and a pretty murderous hand, really, of empire that's below the surface.
But, Mr. Good, I think for many decades, the Americans at least try to keep the pretenses. I mean, this myth that you described just now, I mean, it was relevant when I was coming of age, but I think over the last couple of decades, it's pretty clear to everyone around the world that it's simply not accurate. And the gap between what is being projected and what is being perceived is enormous and perhaps working against the United States. Why do you think the sort of the masterminds behind this project haven't taken much care about adopting this myth so that it would be believable?
I believe that the trajectory of U.S. imperialism to become more overtly lawless, gangsterish, imperialist in the 21st century is the result of political battles among the elites in the United States. And the last person who was not a neoconservative or really opposed neoconservatism, and this is very strange to learn because he's a conservative figure and a very a problematic figure in many, many ways for me as a person who's on the left politically, it was George H.W. Bush. And when he was defeated in 1992, very surprisingly, he came to believe it was due to Israel and the Israel lobby, their influence. But that marked a moment in which there was a transition at the apex of U.S. power. And these neoconservatives who are propelled, I believe, most decisively by, it's a coalition of military contractors, you know, various oil people, various corporate enterprises and so on. But it's also, it's driven largely by I believe, and cobbled together, held together by Zionist oligarchs in the U.S. Especially. They have a lot of money, and they put money into controlling Congress. And H.W. Bush tried to force Israel to create a Palestinian state, and the forces arrayed against him led to his defeat. And after this, you have a transition beginning with Bill Clinton, but especially dramatic with George W. Bush, where they go on this plan of invasions and remaking the Middle East in ways that other people would have thought were not wise. They tried to do the Iran war back in 2006, 2007, and you had establishment people like Brzezinski saying, don't attack Iran, this is crazy. And and in 2006, they were able to stop this. But the power of these forces, and I believe their devotion to this insane Greater Israel project, they captured the apex of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and the results are the disastrous wars of the 21st century culminating in this war with Iran, which I believe is cataclysmic for the U.S. empire.
Now, this sense of the state of emergency, which you mentioned, is very convenient for foreign policy. I think every single escapade or foreign operation was launched on some sort of that pretext. But I wonder if it's also feeding into the American domestic policy. When I was preparing for our conversation, it occurred to me that this heightened sense of drama or excessive emotionality of the American political discourse or the American elections may also have something to do with this constant state of emergency and keeping your population in this chronic post-traumatic stress disorder that, you know, it has no capacity to think rationally about things and always have to be in a sort of reactive emergency mode. What do you think about that?
Yes, it has many impacts domestically. I mean, to be socialized under such a system, you have to accept a whole lot of untrue things about the world and the way the world works and what the government is doing. We have people, I mean, obviously the people who go off and fight in these wars, if they don't get killed, they often come back with bad PTSD. I mean, things like 9/11, which seems to have been a spectacle to kick off the wars of the 21st century, this was in a way inflicting PTSD on the whole country, because you traumatize them with this horrific violence on TV and they play it over and over again, and then we're ready to go into war in Afghanistan and Iraq. So the psychology of Americans with revelations like this and Epstein, I feel that we have not really caught up to processing the criminality that we have seen and the real nature of this regime. But it's becoming clearer now, and I think the Gaza genocide, in a way, this is Western imperialism. I mean, this is the tying together of the Greater Israel Project with the U.S. Global Dominance Project is what we've seen, and it does have domestic impacts. And these forces have intervened domestically in other ways too, besides on mass psychology level. I mean, they killed President Kennedy in 63. They killed his brother in 1968. Nixon was removed from power by these same sort of forces. So we just haven't been able to process what's been happening to us in the United States, because even with all these revelations, mainstream discourse doesn't really internalize them and look at past history in light of what we now know about this regime. And so we're in a strange state of not knowing what really our government is doing and why it is doing it and what it plans for the future. It's a strange position for this supposedly free and open society, all for the people in it.
You know, when I think about the United States, it reminds me of the Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, somebody who was born with sort of a mature disposition and over the course of a lifetime regressed into infancy. And you know, all the things that you have just listed, notwithstanding, the United States started off with a truly amazing set of ideas way ahead of its time. When do you think those principles started to fall off and became such a ruse?
Well, you look at what the U.S. really was at the beginning, and the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, the Revolutionary War, so-called really War for Independence, these also were taking place over an era in which we landed in North America. I say we, but obviously not me. English colonists landed in America, and they weren't there for subsistence farming. They wanted to find ways to make money. And that's really what the U.S. has always been. It's always been a business enterprise. And democracy, even as suffrage, you know, voting rights expanded in the U.S., it was still dominated by wealthy people and different wealthy interests. So they were always doing things that were pretty terrible in terms of genocide of the Native Americans. And then for different economic reasons and political reasons, they adopted the use of African slaves as labor, especially in the South, of course, first for tobacco, but then for cotton. And so this was pretty vicious. It's only in the mid-1800s that they get rid of slavery. But then they take, you know, just before the Civil War, they stole essentially California from Mexico. But once they go from sea to shining sea, the U.S. could have focused on its building up its own economy, taking care of its own people, creating institutions that would make the U.S. prosperous and make the people, you know, provide for their welfare. But they immediately want to go further and further into the Pacific. You know, they go further and further west. They've already gone to the ocean, but then they just go to Hawaii. They fight the Spanish-American War. They sail into Tokyo Bay. That was, you know, around the mid-1800s. So the people in charge, the most powerful people, the richest people, have wanted this empire. And so it was never really, there was a very tiny period under Roosevelt, you know, the good neighbor era, we could call it, where the U.S. wasn't practicing much imperialism. But beyond that, it's been imperialistic from the start.
Okay, well, Mr. Good, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this conversation in a moment. Stay tuned.
I see you're washing the Moscow mules. And we're gonna brainwash the crap out of you.
Getting word from Red Square.
Who are you? I don't care what my voters say.
I am not a warmonger. I am a peacemaker.
Eating the dogs, eating the cats.
Huggy, there you go. All squeaky clean.
Fiji used to be one of the most remote outposts of the British Empire. But when Britain finally pulled out of the islands in 1970, it left behind a racial time bomb.
And my grandfather, he hated the British because we had created this horrible situation, and my mother had learned from him, and I learned from him. I didn't like the British neither.
Let's dig back the past and see what corruption is. How thousands of acres of the best land in Fiji were bought for muskets and mirrors and pipes. How the land of the Suva people was sold off.
That brought about, all up, probably about 3,000 or 4,000 Europeans to live in Fiji to a place that had probably had 30 or 40 Europeans previously.
It has really changed the way we live and the way we think by colonizing our minds.
To give the constitutional instruments of independence of Fiji to the Prime Minister.
After independence, I decided to remain a Fijian. I could have taken my American citizenship then, but I didn't. Could have stayed a British subject, but I didn't. I am proud of being a Fijian. I am a Fijian.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Aaron Good, a political scientist and author of the book American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. Mr. Good, your country is about to celebrate its semi-quincentennial or the 250th anniversary, and a number of polls conducted on the eve of the anniversary show that a large number of Americans don't believe that the American system can endure another 250 years or believe that the state of American democracy is in great danger. I wonder if you find it as a good sign that people en masse no longer fall for this myth of the great American illusion.
Well, I think it's encouraging in conjunction with international events, things that are happening politically at the moment that are historic events. They suggest that the U.S. empire is really crumbling, if it hasn't already, that a multipolar world is emerging, that the U.S. has adversaries that it really cannot surpass for various reasons. And so it is fortuitous, in a sense, that it is collapsing, because the technology that they want, that they would like to be able to develop, is so frightening that the world and Americans too really need to be rooting for the end of the U.S. empire as soon as possible, because it is the wherewithal, the wealth generated by the empire that gives these oligarchs the ability to pursue their insane pipe dreams of, AI surveillance, this sort of RoboCop world they want to try to build with it. They don't even really want to invest in the American people and try to develop American technology for human purposes, to develop the human capacities of people to create solutions to problems. Mm-hmm. So this is, it's encouraging that the world and the American public is increasingly disgusted by the U.S. regime.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a system that is so overheated, over-dramatized, and overly lopsided, how does one even execute the genuine structural change, and how does one register it? Because every single candidate at every election predictably promised change and invariably did more of the same.
Well, the circumstances are going to be changing. The power of the U.S. to determine the outcomes around the world is vanishing. Look at the failed Ukraine war, the failed occupation of Afghanistan. The Iraq war was a disaster, and we haven't been totally defeated there yet, in a sense, because we still have bases there. We still have control of the oil revenues of the Iraqi government. We wire those through the Fed or something crazy like that. So the circumstances for U.S. leaders are going to make it so they can't keep doing the same things, because the rest of the world is not there for the taking anymore.
Well, the rest of the world may not be there, but there's also the American people that, in a sense, that they do not support this system, but I suppose they don't have any other alternative. And I also want to ask you a question about how this sort of sense of exceptionalism or a sense of emergency on the political level is mirrored by your very peculiar economic system, which is capitalism. Which is a chicken and which is an egg in this particular case?
Well, the issue with capitalism and the changing of this system is really key, because the problem in the U.S. and with U.S. politics is that it's not really a democracy, a rule by the people, rule by the demos. It's an oligarchy. And the only ways that you could organize politically for on the scale that would be needed in the U.S. with our system is by having lots of money. We would need somehow to have billionaires who want to reform the system in such a way that there would no longer be billionaires. And you can't get billionaires to do that. There's not a one of them who's really out there paying to create good media or good institutions to shape political culture. The ones that do have money that seem to be critics of imperialism are invariably, they are soft critics who pull a lot of punches. So we have a kind of fake version of anti-imperialism a lot of the time. And the politicians on the left are few and far between, and the Democratic Party is not receptive to reformist impulses, really, at this point. So there doesn't seem to be much to do. And the people outside of the Democratic Party, to the left of them, for example, more anti-imperialist, are not even really united in a way to where we could point to, like, a 4% voting bloc. Like, they don't really... So it's a difficult situation to know what can be done. And that's why, to me, it's... The international situation has to change, and the empire has to collapse, and then the oligarchs will be forced to kind of confront reality of, like, how can we reform the system? Because countries like China especially are just going to destroy us in terms of competition for technology and advancements and so on. It's very clear that our system just is not the dynamic, innovative system that it once was. And there are better systems.
Certainly, but your system is still producing some very strange phenomena. And I'm talking here about this very interesting creature of American politics. This pair of political exceptionalism and hardcore capitalism has produced a very interesting breed of spirituality. I'm talking about the Christian eschatology, which is a major driving force behind many of Trump's initiatives. And in a sense, it's also, you know, an ideology of the religious state of emergency. They literally want to bring about an apocalypse. And when you have, you know, people with such a worldview, with such powerful resources, both money and influence, influencing political leaders like President Trump, I wonder if civic politics even stands a chance, because nobody can rise to that level of fanaticism, let alone of, you know, dedication and resources that are allowed to them.
Yes, and these fanatics do not represent the majority of the American people, and I think that their power is related to the power of Zionism in the United States. They seem, their ideas of, like, the way that Israel is going to be involved in bringing about the rapture, this is convenient for Zionists in the United States as a way to mobilize a voting bloc that will support essentially neoconservative, super pro-Israel policies. So this, it does become a problem in a sense, because they've wanted to have some people who think that way in positions of power. Apparently, you know, you look at what's happened with Iran and the ceasefire or the memoranda of understanding that they're working on towards. And it seems that the people who are connected to actual material reality have enough power still that we did not go further with this, apparently, although you can never predict. I mean, Trump, everything is still in the range of what's imaginable, including just U.S. nuking somebody tomorrow. I mean, this is a dangerous regime.
But Mr. Good, to use this metaphor of the latter days, I think no matter how powerful, inflated or insane a system is, sooner or later it does come to some sort of a structural crisis when the mechanism that used to produce it with income and influence no longer work or work against it. Do you think the United States on a structural level has come to a point where its own structure is working against it?
Yes, it has generated its own nemesis. Dialectically, this is what happens to empires. They create groups that are too greedy and rapacious, and they forget the qualities and values and virtues that made a country prosperous and powerful in the first place, and there's just much greed and corruption all around. It's not unlike the dynastic cycle in China, where these governments come in, these family dynasties come in, and they make reforms, positive changes, but over time, they become more and more corrupt, and eventually the dynasties fall, and they are deemed to have lost the mandate of heaven at that point. So I believe that that is what we're living through. It's an era of high corruption. It's the end of an empire. And it's pretty spectacular because this is an empire of spectacle like nothing the world has really seen in its history. This is we are going to be studying this afterwards. Hopefully, if we don't blow up the world, we will be trying to figure out how this happened, because it's really wild to look at the U.S. and what it became. And Trump is just the most obviously unhinged thing.
I agree with you. It's very spectacular, but I think you need to keep a safe distance from this marvelous show. Now, you mentioned President Trump, and he came to power by lashing out at many of the mechanisms and institutions that previously used to serve the American power. And I think by now it's pretty clear that he will not be able to reform them in any consistent or coherent way for the Americans. But I think for the rest of the world, he also made it clear that the need of separating from the American system is pretty acute, pretty urgent. Do you think the American machinery can continue functioning at least for some years or decades without the rest of the world sort of underwriting it?
This is a good question. Of what's happened with the in the Persian Gulf is something that seems to threaten the current monetary system of the U.S. and the dollar hegemony that the U.S. has enjoyed, which gives the U.S. the ability to run huge military spending deficits, especially year after year, because the whole world accepts the dollar. It's treated like gold used to be treated in the international system, except gold is finite. The U.S. can print infinite dollars, and this is what's allowed it to be so powerful. So how long can they go this way once that material basis for the financial alchemy that they rely on is gone? And the blow of losing the Persian Gulf control over Persian Gulf energy flows and the dollar flows from there, this I think is going to be considerable. It may be the end of the petrodollar. And they have, as we've seen with Russia and with China and with Iran, when the U.S. tried to sanction these powerful countries, they, in a sense, have done them a favor because they forced them to produce, to pursue import substitute industrialization. They create their own products rather than buying things from the Americans. So they develop their own industries, their own technology. They become stronger, which is good. We told people forever that free trade was the way to go, and don't try to pursue import substitutes, just buy imports and so on. But this is bad advice. And we've created the desire for countries to produce their own goods domestically, develop their own technologies, and increasingly to settle payments in other currencies besides the dollar. And this is going to add up more and more over time, and it's going to weaken the U.S. empire, and hopefully in a way that's not going to result in a catastrophic war, because the economic power will not be there. The writing will be on the wall that the U.S. just cannot rule the world anymore.
I think it also increased a hunger and appetite in the world for a more mature, predictable, and perhaps boring, less dramatic system where countries can actually invest in trust, reliability, in pursuing not only very short-term, but like medium-term and longer-term policies. If such system is ever created, do you think the United States is likely to at least not try to sabotage it, let alone joining it?
Well, they've been trying to sabotage this for a long time. And I mean, the one president, John Kennedy, his policies were for more engagement, for winding down the Cold War, for not having the U.S. on a totally imperialist footing all the time, you know, and they killed him. So, yeah, they will try. They're doing everything they can to stop this world from coming into being. They've, you know, the opposition of the Western American, the deep state, to other international statesmen, people like Olaf Palme, Dag Hammarskjöld, Aldo Moro, they've just killed them in the past. Of course, they've killed the leaders in Iran, but they are getting to the point that they can't just murder their way to being back on top.
And absolutely. This and they're also running out of resources. Fortunately or unfortunately for them, they no longer have enough capacity to, you know, orchestrate that on a large scale. Anyway, Mr. Good, it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you very much for sharing your analysis with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart.